listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vikram Chandra, author most recently of Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty, published by Grey Wolf Press. Vikram Chandra was born in New Delhi. In 1984, he graduated from Pomona College with a magna cum laude BA in English with a concentration in creative writing. He then attended the film school at Columbia University in New York. In the Columbia Library, by chance, he happened upon the autobiography of Colonel James Sickender Skinner, a legendary 19th century soldier born of an Indian mother and a British father. This book was to become the inspiration for Vikram's novel, Red Earth and Pouring Rain. He left film school halfway to begin work on the novel. Red Earth and Pouring Rain was written over several years at the writing programs at Johns Hopkins University and the University of Houston. Vikram obtained an MA at Johns Hopkins and an MFA at the University of Houston. While writing Red Earth and Pouring Rain, Vikram taught literature and writing and also worked independently as a computer programmer and software and hardware consultant. His clients included oil companies, nonprofit organizations, and the Houston Zoo. Red Earth and Pouring Rain was published in 1995. The book was received with outstanding critical acclaim. It won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Book and the David Higham Prize for Fiction. A collection of short stories, Love and Longing in Bombay, was published in 1997. It won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best Book, Eurasia Region, and was shortlisted for the Guardian Fiction Prize. It was included in Notable Books of 1997 by the New York Times Book Review, in Best Books of the Year by The Independent, London, in Best Books of the Year by The Guardian, London, and in the 10 Best Books of 1997 by Outlook Magazine, New Delhi. Two of these stories had been formerly published in the Paris Review and the New Yorker. The story Dharma was awarded the Discovery Prize by the Paris Review and was included in the year's Best Fantasy and Horror, St. Martin's Press, 1998. A novel, Sacred Games, was published in 2006 in India and the UK. It was published in January 2007 in the United States. Sacred Games won the Hutch Crossword Award for English Fiction for 2006 and a Salon Book Award for 2007. It was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. It was included on numerous Best of the Year lists and received lavish critical acclaim. Geek Sublime, The Code of Beauty, The Beauty of Code, about the culture of computer programming and classical Indian aesthetics, was published in 2013 by Penguin India as Mirrored Mind, My Life in Letters and Code, and in the UK in 2014 by Faber and Faber as Geek Sublime, Writing Fiction, Coding Software. The book was published in the US by Grey Wolf Press just in September. In June 1997, Vikram was featured in the New Yorker photograph of India's leading novelists. His work has been translated into 19 languages. He co-wrote Mission Kashmir, an Indian feature film that was released internationally in late October of 2000. Vikram Chandra currently divides his time between Mumbai and Berkeley, California, where he teaches creative writing at the University of California. He lives with his wife, the novelist Melanie Abrams. When I spoke with Vikram Chandra by phone earlier this month, I started by asking him to talk a little bit about an early experience of finding computer code beautiful.
Probably the first time that you write some code and then you realize later that you have to change it is when you start thinking, you know, I could have done that better, I could have made it more elegant. And by elegant, what we're doing is referring to an aesthetics of functionality. And that functionality always includes the possibility of future change. So there's certain ways to write code that are architecturally and then syntactically better suited for future change. And so once you start doing that and changing your own code, you start realizing instantly that there are ways to do it that are better. And so probably, I mean, the first time I actually started using a computer was when I first came to the United States, and this was in the early 80s, and at that time I'd never even seen a computer, because in the India of the 70s and 80s, there were computers, but they were at these very elite institutions or they were owned by the government. So I was very excited, and as soon as I got to campus and I enrolled for classes, I ticked off, you know, I marked in that I wanted to take a class in Pascal. And I have to say that I found it intellectually kind of like solving little puzzles one at a time, but finally it grew a little wearisome for me because I couldn't quite see what the practical use was, you know. I mean, sort a list of words, right? And then I figured it out, and then I realized, oh, I can do this better, and then, you know, that was great. But computers at that time, I think many people's experience of them, even when you use them, was kind of distance, because we were working on a mainframe computer at the college that I was at. And so you're working on a terminal, and your time is limited. Somebody's waiting behind you. You don't really have an opportunity to play with it. So it took a while when I actually started working in the real world at a medical transcription job. I got my hands on a PC for the first time. And that's when I really started enjoying it and exploring how to write better code. And I'm calling it code, but at the beginning, it was just, technically speaking, it was just macros. You know, little pieces of functionality that you could set up inside your word processor or little batch files.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny what you say about not knowing how it would be applicable in a larger sense. It just reminds me of when personal computers came out and everybody was like, well, it's really exciting, but what am I going to do with it? Like, what is it just like, is it just a computer, like a typewriter with a screen? Like, what, you know, will I keep my recipes on it? And then people would talk about shopping with it. And it's like, I'm never going to go shopping with this thing. What does that even mean?
Yeah, but I caught the bug pretty early on. As soon as PCs started becoming ubiquitous, you know, in the smallest degree, and also affordable.
Yeah.
Because especially, I mean, like I was saying, at work, at the place that I was working at, I could make my job, which is very boring, you know, copying stuff and writing the same pieces of boilerplate text again and again. I could automate that, and that was the kick.
Yeah. In your chapter called The Language of Logic, you do this wonderful job of explaining computer logic simply so that lay readers like myself might understand. You include diagrams and tables, and I loved that you include the Lego models of logic gates, which is really fun. Did you find it difficult to explain what you know very well for people who don't necessarily know a lot about this technical subject?
Yeah, it took a while to get it so that it assumed absolutely no knowledge at all on the part of the reader. And I should say also, like I say in the book, it's something that's not very legible to your sort of common sense understanding of the world. So Boolean logic plus binary numbers gives us computation, and I didn't understand that, how it actually worked on a mechanical level. All the time that I was programming professionally, it was only afterwards that I got curious about what my code was actually doing. And once I discovered it, it seemed so elegant and so simple. I got really excited, and the first person I tried to tell about this was my wife, Melanie, who's also a fiction writer, and she's absolutely not a geek in any way. So I had, and I realized that while I was trying to explain how all this worked with, you know, I was drawing little diagrams on pieces of paper, and she wasn't getting it, that it actually was something that would require a little work. So in a sense, that was part of the impulse for the whole book, is to make a kind of ethnography of programming for the non-IT person, and then also to try and get across, without doing some sort of hand-waving, how it actually works, how computation works. Mm-hmm. Because I think in popular accounts of computing, often that's what happens, is that they'll tell you that, you know, computer languages are how logic is processed, and then the programmer write something and then a whole lot of zeros and ones happen, and mysteriously somehow that results in computation. And so I didn't want to do that. I actually found the actual mechanics of it so beautiful that I wanted to get across to the reader how that would work. And then I think also going in the opposite direction, we often see the same kind of thing in reference to literary writing. What do literary writers do? What do artists do? Well, they create an ineffable beauty with words. How do they do that? Well, it's ineffable. We can't talk about it. It just
exactly.
kind of happens.
Right. I loved the part of the, this is actually later in the book, but you talk a little bit about that, and you talk about the concept of, is it Dvani?
Dvani, yes.
Yeah, the concept of what's missing. But one thing that you talk about is that when I read Hemingway, I'm going to read it differently than when you read Hemingway. And when you read Hemingway now, you will read it differently than you did many years ago. And the mystery of that is part of what makes it so beautiful.
Right. And so how what the Indian, pre-modern Indian literary theorists, and especially the two that I talked about in the book, did a really good job, I think, of was trying to explore how a certain kind of language becomes beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And what they really, I think, explain well is this notion that since we are absorbing literary language into ourselves, what happens in that language in our interiors is very individual, even as it might have some similarities to how other people experience it. So your memory, your storehouse of experience is what the fiction or the poetry resonates with, and therefore it's all very individual. And even changes from reading to reading, you know, I read Hemingway first when I was, I think, 16, mm-hmm. and I completely, my experience now is very different, but I teach a couple of Hemingway stories once a year, and I notice that each time I reread those in order to teach them, it also changes. And that's one of the wonderful things about art, I think, is that the same text can reveal itself in so many different ways and cause different results.
Yeah. I once heard the writer Larry Sutton talking about why it's hard sometimes to go back to if you write a book and you didn't get it published, and then maybe 20 years later you want to go back and look at it again, you're not the same person you were
right.
when you wrote it. It's hard to return to it. And in a way, that I was reminded of his saying that when I was reading your book, because in a way, when we go back to reread things many years later, sometimes it's such a different experience too, because we change.
Yeah, and I should say that that's one of the risks you take when you read some book that influenced you greatly in your teens or 20s, and you know, you're much older, and you think, oh, I'm so excited, I'm going to reread that, and then you wonder what you saw in it.
And it's so disappointing, it's like you cannot go back.
Right. And then, you know, you've ruined that memory forever. it's a risky business engaging with art, because it changes under your feet, as it were. You know, the ice keeps shifting.
Right. I want to talk a little bit more about programming. You write in Geek Sublime that you do still write programs. So I wondered what kind of programs you write. And then you also said that you write them on your phone, or maybe you said some people do.
Yeah, I mean, it is becoming possible now to, what we're doing really, when you put a smartphone in your pocket, you're carrying a supercomputer around. And I think because we're so used to it, it takes, you know, you have to step back a little and think about it before you realize the absolute wonder of it. So your smartphone, your average smartphone now, is more powerful than the most powerful supercomputer in the world from 1984, which was the Cray 2, right, which cost millions of dollars and was the size of one of those departmental copy machines.
Right.
There's an immense computing capacity in these little devices that we so casually carry around with us. And there is an effort among app makers and such like to make the device more responsive to the user. So there are a couple of, I guess you would call them macro programs. There are a couple of websites that attempt to do this so that, you know, if there's something that you do every day, how do you automate that? So, and that certainly is fun and very useful. And as for doing general programming, I play around with it in a kind of very hobbyist way. You know, I have a, I suppose it's like somebody having a bunch of unfinished novels lying around on their hard disk. I have a bunch of various little utility programs and such like sitting in various stages of development on my computer, and it's my equivalent of going to the garage and building, you know, some sort of really ugly chair or something. It might be for somebody else. I find it really relaxing, and it takes the effort involved is so different from what I spend my life doing in trying to write fiction that it feels like relaxation.
Yeah, that was interesting to me. In the book, you talk about how writing is so hard, it's so painful, and you quote other writers. I mean, obviously, this is, you know, sort of the general consensus that writing is so hard and painful. And then you wrote about how programming, you don't have that same experience. You are alone, and you are working on this other kind of language, but it's not painful like that for you. And I thought that was really fascinating, and I wonder why that is.
Well, I think, I mean, I guess I can speak for myself in that the interesting thing about writing the language of code is that you're solving, when you're trying to build a program, you think about what you want it to do, and then you kind of do a decomposition of functionality. So you break that larger function down into really small pieces of intent, and then you write little snippets of code, each of which solves a particular problem. And the wonderful thing is that then you can test it, right? Mm-hmm. Does it do what I want to do, this little 10-line function that I wrote today? And so you get an instant feedback. You know, it's either successful or not, and there's actually, you run tests, and the tests put these green check marks up on your screen when the code is working successfully. And when you go all green and there's no big red, angry red crosses, it's a wonderful feeling of accomplishment. And so it feels like there's a ludic quality to it. You're always engaging with this machine, and it's kind of like a game you're playing with it. And so you can get really lost in it. And it really doesn't have the kind of intense self-consciousness that trying to write fiction brings to me, at least.
Yeah.
I suppose if you're programming in a corporate cubicle and your boss is, you know, telling you that you need to get this done by tonight, and you're going to have to stay up till 4 in the morning, it becomes a completely different experience altogether. But I think a lot of people are drawn to programming because of this intense feeling of creative satisfaction that it gives you.
Yeah. One of the things that you talk about in the book is the old Apple II computer, and I have to say I smiled when I read that because my husband and I still own his old Apple II computer, and so
that's worth some money now.
Is it?
It is. Those old computers, and I regret whenever I think of those machines that I sort of junked way back in the 80s. All of those are kind of like museum pieces now.
Oh.
And especially if they're still working perfectly, you can actually make some money selling them. People collect them.
I don't think he's going to want to part with it, but
yeah. I would keep it.
I was wondering why, so you say that the Apple II is on every list of greatest computers. Why is that so great? Why is that computer so great?
So Steve Wozniak did an amazing job in building that machine, and partly it was because the mystique of it was also because he did it all himself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he's the engineer, he's the one who designs the operating system, he writes a programming language for it, and he's doing all this while holding a full-time day job at Hewlett-Packard. And there's a kind of, you can see a kind of auteur kind of sensibility in the machine, right? And the wonderful thing about it is that as he puts it, no bugs have ever been discovered in the operating system or in the code. And also, from people who know electronic engineering, regard the circuit design as very elegant and minimal and beautiful. So I think all of those things come together along with its place in computing history in that they were able to take this machine and start, I guess, what you would call the personal computer revolution with it, that gives it its very important place in history.
Yeah, okay. Now, this book came out September 2nd. I'm wondering how programmers are reacting to the book. Have you heard from a lot of programmers about how they're reading it and enjoying it?
Yeah, no, I think I've had a lot of very positive reactions. I've been doing readings and such like for it, and the first kind of public appearance in the States that I did with it, for it was at Microsoft in Seattle.
Oh, wow.
So they have these lunch lectures, which was a little intimidating for me, because, you know, I'm a kind of hack programmer. I sometimes hesitate to even call myself that, and especially in that company, you know, in that
sure.
environment. So I went and did a little presentation for them about the book and about the role that the Sanskrit language played in the history of computing, and showed them a bunch of slides, and they seemed to like it. So that was very, very encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the other wonderful thing was that the first email that I ever got after the book came out in India last year was from a young programmer working in Bangalore. And he said that the book induced in him a sensation of wonder.
Mm.
And that was very pleasing to me, because that's where I started, was trying to get on the page some of my sense of wonder at not just the machinery, but at all the cultural connections and the historical connections that finally have produced our particular historical moment.
Yeah, I was really struck that way as I read it. Just all of the language and cultural references and history and mythology that you weave together to present this history of code and the beauty of it. And I really enjoyed that you came at it from so many different angles. I wonder if that's why he found himself, you know, in such wonder, feeling such wonder. And I wonder, maybe you can talk a little bit about how much did you know you were going to integrate when you started the book? You know, I suspect having read your description of your fiction process that you perhaps don't know everything that's going to happen when you start writing a novel. But I'm wondering, with nonfiction, like, did you surprise yourself at what you ended up including here, or did you know ahead of time all of the different strands that you were going to weave into this?
Oh, no, I absolutely did not know.
No.
In fact, when I first started writing it, I was taking a little break from the fiction that I was working on then, and I thought, oh, I'll spend a couple of weeks and write a little essay about the kind of a little ethnography of programming, which I've been thinking about doing for years, because it's a kind of subculture that has so profoundly changed our world, but it's relatively unknown to people from the outside. So I was thinking of it as a kind of glossy magazine essay, you know, 40 manuscript pages or some, at the maximum. And then once I started thinking about it, it seemed to me a good entrance to the subject would be this question of aesthetics, because that's something that I think about a lot, obviously, when I'm writing fiction. And then programmers also care about beauty, so I thought that's the common connection that that I can use as the beginning of the essay. And suddenly the thing was 60 pages long and 70 manuscript pages. And then once I started thinking about the history of it, and it occurred to me that there is this strange and interesting link between programming languages and this Sanskrit grammar written 2,500 years ago.
So fascinating, yeah.
And that there was a formal language, and by formal I mean defined by a system of rules that controls it very tightly, that I had grown up with a kind of formal language in my backyard, which is to say Sanskrit. So once that opened up, you know, it was just kept getting longer and longer, and I would show versions of it to Melanie, and she would say, yes, very interesting, but where is this going to go? and then quite late in the process, I actually realized, well, I'm writing a book, you know, and that I need to be thinking about it as a book instead of this continuous string of connections. And I have to say that there was a moment when I finally split it apart into chapters, and it came it found its architecture in that moment quite easily, and that was very pleasing.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that's wonderful. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about Sanskrit. You write in the book, modern linguistic theory became the seedbed for high-level computer languages. And you talk about the grammarian from 500 BCE. I think Panini is his name.
Right.
And his book of rules of Sanskrit and how those rules affect computer language. So it was just fascinating. I wonder if you can just talk a tiny bit about researching that aspect of the book, and I'm sure you found it very pleasing.
Right, yes, yeah. No, I mean, it's something that you kind of generally have floating around in your head if you're an Indian. You know that once upon a time there was this great grammarian named Panini who wrote this astonishing grammar. But I think the general knowledge of it is just sort of limited to that. So the wonderful thing about Panini's work is that his grammar is not a paradigmatic grammar. It's not the kind of grammar that, for instance, I learned English from, in which they showed me, you know, this is how the verb, these are the verb tenses, or this is how you decline a verb, and then you sort of have to learn that by heart. And they show you examples, and you look at the examples, and you try to remember how the examples work when you're trying to write yourself or speak yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So Panini's grammar is, it's very short. You can print it out in about 40 pages of normal-sized text.
Really?
It comprises, yeah, it's very compressed. It's written in a kind of specialized, compressed language, and people think that is, scholars think that that might be because the earliest beginnings of the linguistic science culture that he came from was in oral culture, right? So we're talking way back in the second millennium BCE. That's when people start putting together these linguistic sciences on the subcontinent. So you can print it out under 40 pages, in about 40 pages, and it comprises 3,976 rules. And when you look at those rules, they look very much like what a modern programmer would recognize as a rule set that works on strings. So what you do when you want a verb in a particular case, say you want it in first-person singular active, you take one of the verb roots that's given to you along with this grammar, and you start running the rules on it. And there's a particular system that defines which rules run when, and as it goes through each rule, the verb changes. The sound of the verb changes. You augment the string, or you put a prefix on it, depending on what rule is being called. And at the end, there pops out this word that you can then start to use. And it also produces sentences in the same rule-driven way. So the grammar has an interesting career both in India and outside. In the West, it's discovered in the 18th and 19th centuries by the Orientalist scholars, and the Germans are the first to translate it, and then it gets understood in English, and it becomes one of the central influences of modern linguistic science.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, Ferdinand de Saussure, who we know as the father of structural linguistics, was a Sanskrit professor. Leonard Bloomfield, who sets the direction of much of American linguistics in the 20th century, was also a Sanskrit professor. Noam Chomsky, with his generative linguistics, talks a lot about his debt to Panini. So how to define a language in terms of itself using meta-language is something that goes back all that way. And in the mid-40s and 50s, when programmers are trying to get away from giving commands to a machine in zeros and ones, in binary code or hexadecimal code, they're looking for ways to define formally languages, right? And the trouble with giving instructions to a computer in a language is that it has to be very tightly defined. Because unlike spoken language, if we don't use exactly the right syntax when giving a command to a computer, it will not understand it, right? It'll just refuse to compile.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that the people who invent or put together the first programming languages look to linguistic science. And there they find these ideas of language generation, which then you can link back in a kind of broad way to Parnini's work.
That is so interesting.
And the interesting thing about his grammar within the Indian subcontinent is that it becomes this most influential grammar or system of Sanskrit, and which is not to say that there aren't other ones, and but it's so vastly influential that it overshadows all the other people thinking about language, or at least generating language. And what it does to Sanskrit is that it makes it, in a sense, a stable language, because it gets so tightly defined by this rule set that it doesn't drift like other languages have, right? Mm-hmm. So if you read Beowulf, you can see how far English has changed. The interesting thing about Sanskrit is that there are general trends across the centuries. So for instance, in the second millennium of CE, there's people love to use long compound words like the Germans do, right? And but in general, if you read a Sanskrit text from, say, the second century CE today, you'll be able to read it quite transparently, right? And that if you got a modern Sanskrit scholar to write a letter in grammatically correct Sanskrit and you time machine it back 2,000 years, they would be able to read it as well. So it became really interesting for me in thinking about the question of beauty in formal languages in terms of computer languages, to look at how people thought about beauty in reference to the Sanskritic world. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's an enormous body of what they call kavya, poetry or literature, that was produced in Sanskrit as well. So the people, the theorists thinking about this, came from this tradition of understanding language in a generative sense, and in that particular linguistic tradition. So the kinds of questions they asked were, I wouldn't say similar, but have relevance to the kinds of questions that we are asking about computing languages today.
Yeah, okay. It strikes me that the reason that his text is still the last word, so to speak, on Sanskrit, it seems like something that must be so comprehensive and yet is so compressed. That in itself must be an incredible thing of beauty, that he's done it so, you know, in 40 pages is just nothing.
I should qualify that in that it's the original text is not perfect in the sense that there are gaps in it. Later theorists and grammarians pointed out certain amendments that they wanted to make. So so it's a self-correcting kind of tradition. But in general, it is a kind of supremely elegant act of the intellect, you know, and it became the model for all knowledge production on the subcontinent. This idea of compression, right, and of describing a system in as comprehensive a way as you can. And so if you look at texts even in other disciplines, like maybe some of the listeners would have tried to read the Yoga Sutras, which is the central text of the yoga tradition. They can be kind of hard to read because the sutras are completely economical and they don't give you a lot of context. And the reason for that is that everyone is trying to reproduce this kind of compression, and you're supposed to read the sutras and learn about whatever discipline it is in the context of a teacher, right, a guru, or in a school, which would provide the context. But it's very, very influential in a general kind of way as well.
Yeah. Now, just talking about compression reminds me of something else that you wrote in the book, which is sort of the computer programs, as they get more and more sophisticated, they really can't be compressed. They get bigger and bigger and bigger. And and you say, and that's not really the point you were just making about Sanskrit, but I'm taking us in that direction, but you said that if you've ever written code, the fact that so much software works so much of the time can seem profoundly miraculous. And I thought that must really be true. I mean, you see just when you look at these lines of things that come up on the computer in, I don't know, in movies or whatever, and it just looks like it's just phenomenally dense. So do you know how to look at that stuff and find things?
Well, you know, one of the things that programmers are always told to do is to sort of become better programmers is to read code, read other people's code. And there's a kind of skill at doing that as well, because the interesting thing about programs is that some of them are very, very large. And in fact, people have argued that software programs are the largest artifacts that human beings have ever built. So just to give you one example, there's a 2008 distribution of the operating system Linux, which comprises 200 million lines of code.
Oh my God! Right?
And so it's crazy to think of that, and it's, you know, of course that's been put together by a legion of individuals working collaboratively for years and years, but the problem then becomes that it has to be understandable from a line-to-line level, right? So that's why there's so much of a emphasis placed on clarity and expressiveness.
Right.
So if I'm reading down a screen full of code, I want it, in a sense, to tell me a story about what it's doing. So you're not really writing code, as Donald Knuth pointed out, for the machine. You're writing it for all the other programmers who will have to read it in the future.
Yeah.
But then beyond that, the sort of the micro view, the architecture of the code also has to reveal intent in some ways, in very clear ways, because how do you hold all these scattered pieces, 200 million lines of code, which are maybe in millions of files, in thousands of folders, right? How do you understand that? And so that the very structuring of all of that has to also reveal intent. So what happens, though, is that with some programs where you've maybe had hundreds of programmers working on the same piece of code for over a period of decades, the organization gets lost, and the code quite literally becomes incomprehensible. No individual or collection of individuals can understand how that thing works. And the technical term, the work of this term of art for this is a big ball of mud.
Yeah.
Right? Everything gets mixed with everything else. And I'm, you know, this sounds like a terrifying exaggeration, but it really isn't. I mean, one of the examples that I use in the book is that the Pentagon's payroll system is a piece of software written in COBOL. It's about 7 million lines of COBOL written in the 60s.
Mm.
And over the years, they've lost the documentation for it. And now it makes errors and, you know, pays people the wrong amount or doesn't pay people. But nobody can fix it because nobody really understands how it works, right? And the impulse then is to say, okay, let's just throw this away and write a whole new program. But when you're writing a very sophisticated program, it takes time. It takes enormous amounts of money. It can cost literally tens of millions of dollars. So sometimes what people prefer to do is to just let the big ball of mud that they have roll on and try and patch it up as you go along, which, of course, results in it becoming even more incomprehensible as you apply each little patch to it.
Yeah. It seems like it's the perfect example that would be what the government is sort of stuck with, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, that was an interesting part of the book, just sort of the things that aren't going well and they're just too difficult to fix. And I'm just wondering, like, when you have something like, you said, that 200 million lines of code that the Linux is comprised of, like, there can't be individual people who know where to go for all of that, right? I mean, it's created teams of people. And is that one open? Is that like an open source where people actually were invited to kind of make their own contributions as well? Is Linux?
Yeah, Linux is open source, and you know, it's headed by what they call the benevolent dictator, Linus Torvalds, who was the creator of the system.
Okay.
And so they're international. It's a globally constructed program, which is open source. And so certainly the people who are at the center of that team will understand its general architecture, and they'll understand how each component, in a sense, fits into the whole system. And that's the nice thing about open source also, is that ideally the more eyes that you have looking at a piece of code, the better.
Yeah.
So the ideal of the open source movement is that we produce better code because we have so many thousands of people looking at it and finding bugs and trying to fix them.
All right, I'm going to take us into talking about writing fiction, because you have this great thing that you write in the chapter. You have a chapter called The Language of Literature. And I loved this. You said, "Sometimes the sheer vastness of what I want to put into fiction terrifies me. I survive by not thinking about the whole. I write my 400 words this day and then another 400 words the next. I find my way by feeling, by intuition, by the sounds of the words, by the characters' passions, by tracking on to the next day, the next rising, and then the next." First of all, I loved that paragraph, and it was very familiar to me, you know, as a writer and somebody who talks to writers. I just wonder if we can talk about this a little bit, the terror of the vastness of what you want to write.
Right. So, yes, there is this, I guess with me the impulse is very strong to be driven by curiosity and then to try and discover, in a sense, how a set of systems work together. And I guess one example that I could use is that my last novel, Sacred Games, is a big 900-page novel about organized crime and policing and terror in India.
Mm-hmm.
And so the place that I started wanting to write that book was very small, or at least local to me, in the sense that in the 80s and 90s, the crime in Bombay was changed from being a kind of local cottage industry, right? The neighborhood tough guys, to becoming much more of a corporate kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that the organizations got larger and larger, and then they were fighting over territory, so they were killing each other in the streets. My father and I actually were within earshot of one gunfight, which involved automatic weapons.
Wow.
Not so far from our home in Bombay, in a northern suburb. So my question was, I just wanted to understand why this was happening, right? And what exactly was going on? And so I started asking questions and meeting with whoever could talk to me about this, journalists and policemen and historians and sociologists. And at that point, I was thinking of it as a tight 225-page thriller. Right? I was going to start with a dead body, and then by the end of it, you were going to know why the body was dead and who had done it. But as I started writing it, I discovered that, of course, you can't talk about organized crime without talking about politics, right? Because the reason that organized crime exists is that there's some sort of exchange of power and value going on in a political sense, with the legitimate centers of power.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm suddenly dealing with local politics, and then I discover, of course, you can't talk about politics today in any part of the world without talking about media and the uses of media and the uses of religion and so forth. So I guess that's the vastness that I was referring to, is that you discover these interconnections between what you first think is your subject and then things that lie slightly outside or in alignment with what you think you're writing about. And at some point, I realized that I was writing a really big book. And that moment is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea how you're going to contain all of this and what its organization and architecture will be. And there's no way, at least for me, to plan ahead of time. The only way I can discover this architecture is by writing through it.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, it just feels like a trek into the unknown. And I think all writers have experienced this. You sometimes have a loss of faith in the project itself, right? Is what I'm doing any good? Does it have any virtue? You know, am I writing the sentence well enough to represent what I wanted to represent? So it can feel like a test of the body and the mind.
Yeah, yeah. What does revision look like after you have a first draft of what will ultimately be a 900-page book? I mean, that would terrify me, the idea that I'm now about to start revising this book. So how did that present for you?
Well, I think with that book it was interesting in that once I realized that it was going to have all these components and these different characters and plot lines and so forth, and also, in a sense, it's a policia. It's a detective story as well as being about a kind of crime novel.
Yeah.
Which, when you're writing that kind of plotty thing, you know, you discover on page 455 of the manuscript that you need something to happen, but you should have planted that 200 pages ago. And I realized that if I started to do that, I would just be caught in endless loops.
And
I would never make any forward progress. So what I did was I just kept writing forward and leaving myself little notes and reminders to get this done during revision. So what I ended up with when I finished the first draft was this complete mess, which had huge gaps in it, but also had these trailing branches that I had started but actually discovered went nowhere. So the first revision was consisted of just starting on the very first page of the book and then going through page by page and trying to clean all of this up.
Wow.
And I think it took me a good 6-8 months to get through that.
Yeah.
But I have to say that for me, when I get to that point in writing a book, it's a much more relaxed and joyful process because it feels like I've done all the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And that everything is there, but now I'm moving around little pieces and I'm shifting the things from here to there and trying to find solutions to specific problems. There were many, many revisions after that. I think I probably spent at least a year and a half, maybe 2 years, in just trying to control this and find the architecture for it and fit it all together.
And while you were in that part of the process, were you involving an editor yet, or did you do this sort of all on your own and then show it to an editor when you felt like it was no longer, you know, a big ball of mud or whatever?
Yes. Well, my wife, Melanie, was the first reader for it.
Oh, sure.
It was kind of funny because, my then-girlfriend, I suppose I should say, when I first met her, you know, she was also she's a fiction writer, a novelist, and she said, you know, what are you working on now? And I said, this novel. And she said, where are you in it? And I said, the middle. And then when we started seeing each other, I was in the middle of this novel forever and ever and ever. And so when I finally, in that first draft, wrote the final words of the final sentence of the thing, I walked across the apartment and she was taking a nap in our bedroom, and I pulled at her foot and woke her up and said, I finished. And she said, finished what? And it was very exciting. But then the strange thing about that was that until I got my first revision done, I couldn't show it to her because it would have made no sense to an outsider, right, to somebody who wasn't inside my head. So then she had to wait a few months till I could actually show her first draft. And then we worked on it together until we actually sent it to my agent, Eric Simonoff, and he was the first to see it outside of the family, as it were.
Okay.
And then the editors came in at a much later stage after we had contracted to publish the book and so forth.
And did they have a lot that they wanted you to change at that point or not?
You know, surprisingly, not that much. I mean, there were specific kind of line notes all through the book, of course, you know, and things where it needed more clarity. But what both Melanie and I had been hoping was that somebody would show me how to shorten the book by a large amount. Mm-hmm. And we'd already tried, right? I kept before sending it out to editors, I kept taking out chapters and chunks of the book and then reading through and trying to see whether it could do without that, and I always ended up putting them back in.
Yeah.
And Melanie couldn't find anything either. So I was thinking that once an editor gets her hands on it, maybe we'll be able to bring it down to some sort of, you know, more human-seeming length. But we went through the same process. We kept taking out parts and then putting them back in because the thing didn't work. So finally, I think, at least I think, that it's a book that is necessarily 900 pages long, because we tried alternates and they didn't work.
Well, it's been a very successful book, so that's good.
Yeah, I was very happy with it, and I think it's found its readers in the world.
Yeah. All right, so we're almost finished, Vikram. I just want to ask I'm wondering, what are you reading these days that you might recommend?
Oh, I have very specific recommendations. So for the past year or so, I've been trying to think about how to write about the past, and I mean the distant past, not the early modern or not the 19th century, but about people living in worlds further back than that.
Okay.
And it seemed to me that there's always a couple of ways that people go about doing this. One is to essentially take modern characters and kind of plonk them into the past, mm-hmm. right? So you've got a detective, but he's working in ancient Rome, investigating a murder, and he is called a finder or a discoverer or something like that, which, you know, is great fun, but it's clearly anachronistic and doesn't quite work for me. And then the other thing that people tend to do is to just simplify people, right? So you have this people talking that funny swords and sandals language, you know, go thou to the tavern and fetch me a glass of wine, which also is very annoying. So I've been asking people, various people, what are good examples of what fiction said in the past? And a few months ago, I was at a festival in Australia, a writer's festival, and three people recommended to me, you know, go read Mary Renault, and a specific book, actually. The King Must Die, The King Must Die. So I was sitting at lunch with these critic and two writers, and I said, you know, what do you recommend? And as if with one voice, they all said, The King Must Die by Mary Renault. And I immediately went and found myself a copy and read it, and I was just ecstatic about it. A long time ago, in my 20s, I had read her three books about Alexander the Great,
yeah.
and really enjoyed them, but I hadn't ever read her recently. And The King Must Die is a wonderful book. It's the legend of Theseus, except that she tells the story of this man in a way that's archaeologically and historically correct, as far as we can tell. But you can see how his exploits or his adventures would have turned into legend. And it's a very complex, vividly evoked world, and the people feel real and complicated and honorable, and they're trying to do the best they can in a very violent universe that in certain ways is very different from ours, but it's also comprehensible. And the wonderful thing about it is that when I got to the end that there's actually a sequel called The Bull from the Sea, and that's, I think, an equally good book. So I would highly recommend those two. And Mary Renault in general, I think, is a writer to be read and enjoyed.
Okay, wonderful. That's great. Now, it says toward the end of your book that you were going to take a sabbatical, and you were going to write fiction, learn a functional programming language, and learn Sanskrit. So I wondered if you've had that sabbatical yet. When does that happen?
Yeah, no, it's already happened, and I am doing all three. I'm back to working on the fiction that I took a break from when I started writing this nonfiction book. I have learned a functional programming language called Clojure, which was quite a revelation to me. And then I have been trying very slowly and painfully to teach myself Sanskrit again. I had 2 years of it in sixth and seventh grade, and I ran away from it because it seemed so boring the way they taught it. So I've been slowly, I'm probably reading Sanskrit now at some sort of kindergarten or first grade level. So I'm not very far in it, but it's been a fascinating trip all around.
No, that's great. Are you now presently on sabbatical?
No, I'm not. I'm back teaching.
Oh, you're back. Okay.
I wish I were.
All right. Well, this has been a real pleasure. I'll just say my guest has been Vikram Chandra. The book is Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty, published by Grey Wolf. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I very much enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Vikram Chandra. You can learn more about his work at his website, vikramchandra.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post on Facebook. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about someone's first experience using a computer. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Thank you so much for listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.